Good morning. This is Bob Mann in for Jim Inkster, who's off today. On this morning's show, we'll discuss the almost completed session of the Louisiana legislature. Things are coming down to the wire at the state capitol today and tomorrow. And the big question is, will we have a budget or will there be a special session? We'll discuss those issues with State Representative John Bell Edwards of AMEET and Senator Robert Adley of Bossier Parish. We'll also talk about the joys and challenges of caring for wildlife as an amateur. We'll be joined by a couple of people who know that subject very well. All of this on today's show, but first the news from NPR on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Good morning, I'm Bob Mann, filling in for Jim Inkster. On today's show, we're talking about the almost completed session of the Louisiana legislature. Tomorrow, as you know, is the last day, and the big question is, will there be a budget? If you'd like to join our discussion this morning, the number to call is 225-297-5633, that is, or you can send an email to inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined on the phone today by two members of the legislature who are very involved in these issues, Representative John Bell Edwards of AMEET, who is the leader of the House Democratic Caucus, and also by Senator Robert Adley, a Republican who represents Bossier Parish in the Senate. Thank you both for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you, Bob.
So the question on everyone's mind today is, will we have a budget or a special session? Representative Edwards?
Well, I'm optimistic that we'll have a budget. You know, it almost always happens that way, and we're in the stage of the process now where we have a conference committee appointed by the House and the Senate, and of course, everybody participating are competent officials who are you know, negotiating in good faith and very reasonable people. So I'm optimistic that we will be able to bridge the differences and get something done.
Senator Adley, you agree?
I do agree. I think we will. I think history proves that it will occur. It's been, I think, 60 years since we actually left here without a budget. We had one time where it was purely a technicality and procedural where it rolled over for an extra week. But beyond that, we generally get it done. I mean, that's what they sent us here to do, and I think we will.
So one of the bits of information that was missing from the Advocate story this morning was who exactly is on this committee. It's a larger committee than usual, six from each body, right? Who are the do either one of you know who all the members are?
Well, I'm happy to tell you who the House members are, and I'll let Senator Adley give you the Senate members. But we have the Speaker of the House, Chuck Cleckley, and the Chairman of Appropriations, Jim Fannin. In addition to that, we've got Lance Harris, myself, Katrina Jackson, and Cameron Henry.
And Senator Adley, do you know the Senate members of this committee?
Well, there are only three on our side, and I assume they will be the chairman of Revenue, which is Riser, the chairman of Finance, which is Donahue, and the president of Senate, Mr. Alario.
Now, how does that work when you've got six members of from representing one side and three on the other? How do you decide who prevails in that kind of situation?
Well, they just need more numbers.
The Senate needs to appoint three more?
No, look, their body is twice our size. The way it works is pretty simple. The majority vote on their side dictates what they do, and the majority vote on our side dictates what we do.
Okay, so the differences between the House budget and the Senate budget are pretty enormous. So what do you think will be the compromise? Where is there room for compromise, Representative Edwards?
Well, I'm not certain that the differences are as big as maybe you think they are. I think it's going to come down in large part to how many non-recurring dollars are in the budget and lined up against recurring expenditures. That is something that a large number of House members have been concerned about, and I think there's a way to address that. I know that some members are also concerned about a handful of fiscal reform bills that haven't quite made it all the way through, but very close, and I'm optimistic that that's going to work out too. And I really don't want to negotiate through the radio because we're going to be meeting later this morning, and I don't want to do anything that might inadvertently poison the atmosphere when we do get together later this morning.
Senator Adley, where do you stand on this non-recurring money or the one-time money that's become so contentious in this session?
Well, I think first it's important to understand there are two types that are critical here that the public generally doesn't quite follow. One is our non-recurring rainy day money that we set up for the ebb and flow of our revenue because we're an oil and gas state as our dollars go up and down. Using that money, but from my view, government should never have a savings account. We either ought to give the money back to the taxpayers or we ought to spend it for their benefit. Creating savings accounts outside of dealing with your cash flow problems because you're an energy state, my view is you either give it back or you use it.
Representative Evers, does that square with your thinking on that?
Well, no, I'm not in agreement with Senator Adley on that. I think it does make sense to have a budget stabilization fund to tide us over when we do have periods where revenue dips and we have critical priorities that we want to fund and maybe bridge the gap until revenues increase. But beyond that, I will tell you that when you talk to the fiscal analysts around here, the economists, putting a precise definition on what is one-time money is very, very difficult, and there are almost as many reasons to declare any revenue source as recurring as is non-recurring. Sometimes it's a very academic discussion around here, but I will tell you that is an issue that energizes a fair number of folks in the House.
And I think she's right about that. And I will tell you, Bob, from at least from my side, from me personally, as far as non-recurring money goes, there are only two funds that I look at and say, look, I don't think we ought to be touching these. And those are funds that generate fees, and fees by the Constitution aren't supposed to be any greater than what it costs to provide the service. So in my view, you ought not be touching those things because I think you violate Constitution when you do that. The other fee that's out there or the other fund is the Transportation Trust Fund, which consists of a tax levied by the taxpayers themselves on themselves years ago for their roads. And over the years, we've continually dipped into that fund. I think that's a mistake. Beyond that, though, I think Representative Edwards is right. I think you can define it almost any way you want to define it. And the truth of the matter is it's the taxpayers' money. And those that don't want to spend it ought to give it back to them. We ought not be creating savings accounts.
We are talking with Representative John Bel Edwards, the Democratic House leader, and Senator Robert Adley of Bossier Parish. And we're talking about the closing days of the legislative session. Tomorrow is the last day. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, please call us at 297-5633 or send an email to inkstershow@wrkf.org. Let's talk a little about some other money, and that involves education. So the Supreme Court overruled the way that the legislature set up the voucher program last year. Now that money's got to come from somewhere else, and some of it needs to be paid back. Where is that going to come from?
Well, the supplemental budget bill that came back from the Senate to the House, I think it's up for concurrence today, contains the money necessary to repay the school districts for the local share of the per-pupil allocation that was diverted for the voucher program. And so that is certainly a good first step, and that's going to happen. I have no doubt about that. The bigger issue for me, Bob, is that the MFP resolution from last year was declared to be unconstitutional, so we have now reverted back to the 2011-12 resolution that funds our public K-12 school systems, and because of that, I believe that if you read the Constitution and the 11-12 resolution, that we are required in the current year, that is the year we're in right now, to increase the base per pupil amount by 2.75%, which is basically an inflationary increase. And so that is not something that is universally accepted in the legislature, but that is my position. And so I believe that the supplemental appropriations bill ought to have that increase in it, too, which is about $67 million dollars, so it's not an insubstantial sum, and that's what makes it difficult.
Senator Attlee, you think we ought to, as Senator, as Governor Evers, as Representative Evers says, we he likes that, the sound of that, and I'm going
to
ask.
Look, I got to take this moment to say this. I think John Bell is one of the rising stars in the legislature. I've been here a long time. He's done an excellent job since he's been here, and I encourage him in his race for governor. I can tell you, as one who made the race, everybody ought to do that at least once in their life.
Well, before we get off the air, I want to invite you to give him some advice, because you did run for governor many years ago.
Raise money.
Yeah. So
the issue on the MFP, John Bell, we have a difference here, and he said it, that we do. There are a number of legislators that do disagree over this mandated increase in the MFP. He is correct, I think, that we have to revert back to the MFP we had because of the court case. But because of the court case, this is a one-year issue, and a one-year issue only, because BSEE adopts the MFP every year. The issue in the court was you cannot fund private schools out of the MFP that's set up for public schools, and that was a court ruling. I agree with that. You can't do that. But if you're still going to fund the voucher, what BSEE will do is simply present us an MFP each year and the voucher bill was proposed by them. I assume they will present an MFP that's reduced to cover the cost in years to come so that you continue to be able to pay for it. The issue is a one-year issue, and how do you get to it this year? How do you deal with it this year? And the Senate took the budget, and I think we found a way to appropriate for the vouchers this year outside of the MFP, and then move forward in MFP, and inside that MFP, we actually put a supplemental raise for our classroom teachers. But now that's meeting with some opposition in the House, where the House, and on John Bell's credit, what he would like to do is put it in recurring forever. We'd like to get it in and try to get it to the classroom.
Let's go to the phones right now for a question from Chris on Segan Lane. Chris, you're on the air with John Bell Edwards and Robert Attlee.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for letting me speak to your guests. I had a question regarding the Medicaid expansion and how that ties into the budgetary process. And, you know, I was just wondering what their thoughts were on taking or on doing the Medicaid expansion as a way to save the state money and to fill some budget holes. I know there was a piece in the Washington Post, I believe it was yesterday, that said, you know, basically the gist of it was that states that don't expand and don't take these federal dollars are not only morally irresponsible for not, you know, covering their citizens, but fiscally irresponsible for not taking those dollars and using them to benefit their economies and their growth. So I just wanted to get their thoughts on that.
Mr. Edwards, we're going to take you first. We've got about 2 minutes till we need to take a quick break. So we'll go to you first, and then we'll come back after the break and let Senator Attlee tackle that question.
Okay, well, I'm in favor of the Medicaid expansion, and I thought an instrument that would have directed DHH to expand eligibility for Medicaid in order to take advantage of it. Our fiscal staff here in the legislature said that over 10 years, worst case, we would save $200 million, and best case, we would save $500 million by doing the expansion. I also know that the universe of people that are at issue are the working poor. The poor already have the Medicaid cards. And most importantly for me, the current way that we reimburse providers to care for our uninsured is going to go away. The federal government is going to reduce our DSH dollars and our UPL dollars as a way to pay for the Affordable Care Act. And so if we don't take advantage of the opportunity that we have to expand the Medicaid rolls, we're not going to have a way to pay our providers for that care. Now, that's not an acute problem short term, but within about 3 years, it will be. But if we wait till then to do the expansion, we will have missed all of the 100% match rate years, and we're going to buy into the program when it's actually the most costly.
When do we miss out on that opportunity to get all 3 years?
Well, it starts in 2014, and so if you wait till 17 to do it, you've missed it.
We are talking to Representative John Bell Edwards of AMEET, House Democratic Leader, and Senator Robert Attlee of Bossier Parish about the session. We'll come back and let Senator Attlee have a whack at that Medicaid expansion question after this one-minute timeout on WRKF 89.3 in Baton Rouge. And we're back. I'm Bob Mann, sitting in for Jim Inkster today, who's off for a couple of days. We're talking with Senator Robert Adley of Bossier Parish and Representative John Bel Edwards of A-Meet about the waning days of the legislative session. Before the break, we took a question about the issue of whether the state should accept the federal funds to expand its Medicaid program for the working poor, and Governor, I've done it twice now, Representative Edwards, he likes the sound of governor, but Representative Edwards answered the question and before the break, and now Senator Adley, what do you think about the question of whether the state should accept that federal money? That's billions of dollars that we're potentially leaving on the table if we don't.
Yeah, this is one issue that Representative Edwards and I agree much more than we disagree. I'm probably about the only Republican over here that voted not necessarily for the expansion, but for us to put forth a waiver to the federal government to be able to take these dollars, as have some 20 or 30 other states. Arkansas has put together a pretty good plan, it appears to me. I thought we ought to do that. I think it's way too much politics involved. In other words, on my side, we don't like it because we didn't win the White House, but I can't punish the people I represent because we didn't win the White House. On the other hand, on the other side, those people who passed this thing in Washington made it very clear the only way you can get this done is if the governor signs the agreement and is willing to do it, which means the legislature's hands is totally tied. We can do nothing. I mean, we literally can do nothing because it requires his signature by federal law. I thought that was irresponsible. I also think it's irresponsible that we don't find some way to reach out to get these dollars, because we are punishing a lot of people by not doing that. Now, there's a legitimate argument to be made that beyond 3 years, there's some expense to be dealt with. But several plans have been put forth that would eliminate that expense for us. I thought we ought to consider it. I thought we ought to try to move forward with some waiver. But the fact of the matter is nothing's going to happen with it because it's up to one individual in this state.
So I've heard from several people, including Fred Cerise, who was the head of DHH under Governor Blanco, and also head of LSU Hospitals, who has, I think, testified even before the legislature that he thinks that eventually the governor will, and other people I believe have said this as well, they believe that eventually the governor will have to accept this money. He'll have to find some face-saving way to do this. Do either of you agree with that?
Well, I was hoping that was true, but no, I don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, I don't know that this governor will, based on his statements. I mean, he has not left himself any wiggle room at all, and I don't believe that the forces will be brought to bear that will require our expansion until right after his term is over, and so I don't look for that to happen with Governor Jindal.
We may be asking our congressional delegation for some sort of waiver to let us into the program late.
Well, it's not necessarily even a congressional delegation. It's just a matter of Washington itself. And Bob, I want to make this real clear. I don't like Obamacare. I think it was a bad move. I think it's a bad piece of legislation. But again, it's law now, and not to take money that's rightfully ours that could help us save our universities and our healthcare system. I mean, right now, one of the differences in this budget between us and the House is the use of some of these one-time dollars, frankly, because we're having to replace a huge amount of money that's being removed from us.
So we have an email from Kobe, I've slipped up a couple of times and called Representative Edwards Governor Edwards. He is running for governor, but there is another Governor Edwards who was before the legislature recently. And Kobe says, when former Governor Edwards visited the legislature, he asked that the legislature pass a budget that attempts to help the poor and indigent in our state. Can Senator Adley or Representative Edwards point to something in the budget that helps do that? We've been talking about Medicaid, but that's not going anywhere in this session. What else can we point to that actually makes the life of the poor a little easier in Louisiana?
Well, if I can, John Bell, let me jump in here. He's been hitting you first. I'll jump in. You follow me this time, if that's all right. We passed a piece of legislation here this session that dedicated some dollars back to health care using some provider fees. That should go a long way in protecting their budgets in years to come. Now, I have to tell you, I was not a supporter of that simply because I don't believe in dedicated funds, because when you pass that one, everything in this state is now dedicated outside of the university. So now the only thing that will ever be on the chopping block in the future when we're faced with shortfalls are universities. But something was passed to help them. We have done everything we can to stimulate and keep the Department of Health and hospitals and others functional. But that, again, falls back on one of these issues that we have with the House. So they're still asking for more cuts in that area. So, you know, it's back and forth.
Yeah, and I would tell you that I think some of the best work we've done in this session deals with education and training. For example, the Senate found a way to put some money back in the budget for our higher education systems that will hopefully minimize any need for tuition and fee increases that obviously impact the poor more than anybody else. But I want to give Senator Abbey great credit for a bill that he brought that's going to expand access to people in Louisiana to achieve a college, a community college or a technical college degree, because two-thirds of all the people in Louisiana who are going to get a good job are going to have some post-secondary education. And we don't have a community and technical college system today that can meet the needs. And so he authored a bill that's going to commit a considerable amount of money over a period of years, but to produce results very, very quickly by expanding access so that we can get people the training that they need so that they're qualified for good jobs, and that when we have opportunities for economic development and job creation, we've got people right here in Louisiana who are trained and educated to take those jobs, and that's going to absolutely benefit the poor people more than anybody else. And so, Senator Adley, I want to thank you for your work on that issue.
And I want to thank you for your help. I heard your speech on it. It was very helpful. Thank you.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We're talking with Representative John Bel Edwards and Senator Robert Adley. We have Phil on Jefferson Terrace. Phil?
Good morning, sir. And I just have to say, listening to the two of you, I compliment you on your cooperation and just talking in a common sense way about these things, you know, matter of life and death issues that, you know, affect our state. My question to both of y'all is, since it is the job of government to raise revenue, and we have all these tax breaks and tax credits, and also just the very atmosphere of cynicism and distrust that you know, is running around, can you guys like look at a really honest study of what benefits we're getting, and just, you know, where we're dropping the ball on the tax credits and the tax breaks that are being given? Thank you.
I will chime in again and tell you that this past year we spent a year looking at all of those credits, and I think you're on target. The state general fund here is $8 billion, and out of that, over 72% is dedicated. So we're only left with $2 billion we get to manage, which is education and health care, and that creates these problems that we have, that dedication. What creates more problems is we have $8 billion state general fund, and now we have $7 billion in tax credits. We went through every one of them to see what's working and what's not working. And the bottom line is simply this. For every credit we have, the state does not get back the money it puts out. It just doesn't. Now, we're creating jobs, and that is a good thing, but you're creating jobs at the expense of other taxpayers. Other taxpayers have to subsidize it. And so this session, we've looked at a number of credits. We tried to change them. We did move some, particularly with solar tax credits and others. We tried to make changes with those. But into the future, I think we're going to have to reach a point where we say, you know, we're not going to be given any more credits until someone removes one. If you come in for a new credit, you're going to have to find one that's not working you want to replace.
Representative Edwards?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I appreciate the comments by the listener. And I enjoy working with Senator Adley, and we can always talk. But I agree with Senator Adley on this issue. You know, Governor Jindal talks about how we have outperformed the South and our job creation has been better than anywhere else and our unemployment numbers have been better. But it's not producing the revenue that you would expect in order to fund the critical services of government. And we continue to dismantle the institutions people care about, like health care, higher ed, K-12, and so forth. And the reason is we have a structural problem that all revolves around these tax loopholes. And when you close a tax loophole, in my opinion, you are not raising taxes, you are saving money because you're decreasing the spending that you're doing through the tax code. And so I think, and every one of those tax credits and tax exemptions and tax rebates were sold because it was supposed to produce a benefit that exceeded the cost. Well, clearly that is not the way it's working out. And a good objective review of those things would demonstrate that. And we don't need to get rid of all of them. In fact, many of them probably need to remain just as they are. But we certainly ought to be able to pick out the ones that are costing us more than we anticipated and either repeal them or scale them back. And I will tell you, for me, the most objectionable tax loopholes are those that allow out-of-state businesses to move into this state on an uneven playing field and outcompete local small business that have been here over the years that didn't get any help to set up, that have been making payroll and paying their taxes, and then we're going to use their tax dollars to allow somebody to come in and outcompete them, and I think that's a tragedy.
Before the session, in the early day, I guess the early moments of the session, Governor Jindal was pushing his tax reform plan. Those exemptions were lobbyist loopholes, and then suddenly they became something like vital to the state's very survival. What happened there?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to go first, and then, Jim, I've got to leave and go to a meeting on this
one. And we may be going to the same meeting, John Bell.
I will tell you what happened was when the governor was producing his when he was promoting his plan to go to the most regressive, highest sales tax in the nation, he was attacking the lobbyists and lawyers who had gotten loopholes in the tax code to benefit special interests. That was the way he was going to sell his plan. Once he gave up on his plan, and the legislature continued to look at those tax expenditures, he decided he didn't like anymore because I think it interfered with his no new tax pledge, or at least the way he construed his no new tax pledge. And so he convened a meeting on the fourth floor in the press room with all of those same special interests that he had been hammering away at before that. That's what happened there. But I'm thankful that we didn't move in the direction that the governor proposed. And we're going to be on a more solid footing, I believe, as a result of that. And Bob, I do have to run to a very important meeting right now, and
sure.
I'm going to let Senator Adley respond. And I do appreciate you and your listeners for letting me visit with you all.
Representative Evers, thank you so much for being with us today. Good luck for the rest of the session. And I'm sorry we didn't get to the point where Senator Adley was going to give you all that good advice about running for governor.
Well, I'll meet with him later today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Adley?
Bob, thanks. The governor's proposal at the beginning of the session, the income tax swap, I personally thought that could be a positive thing for the state, provided you could do it in a fashion where you didn't give up your revenue you needed to function in the state. And the problem with that is you generally need a three-legged stool of some kind. And in this state, that stool is sales tax, oil and gas revenue, and the income tax. In other states, they all have property tax also on that stool. And when we remove one leg, then it gets very wobbly unless you make one extremely large or you get rid of some of these tax credits. And so for that reason, I think that went away. But I don't want to be too critical of the governor because I thought it was worth a discussion, but it has gone by the wayside. I do want to thank him for his help. The technical college bill that John Bell mentioned, I think, is very, very important to the state. And I can tell you, could not have passed that without his assistance. And we, want to thank him for that. But this process is about people having different ideas, putting them forth, having a legitimate discussion, and trying to fix the problems we have. The Medicaid problem has really made this session very, very difficult. On one side, I want to compliment those people who were able to get it done, without taking the dollars. But on the other side, I certainly would like it a lot better if the dollars of people that I represent were paying to the federal government, I was getting them back. I like that better. But I want to tell you, Bob, I want to thank you. I've known you for years, and thank you for everything you've done and your activity that you've been involved in. But I like John Bell. I am involved in some of these negotiations over the budget, and I have a feeling that's where he's headed, and I knew I was supposed to be there at 9:30.
Okay. Well, could I ask you one more question before
Yes, sir.
Before, on higher education, when are we going to start investing in higher ed and stop deinvesting in higher education in this state?
Well, I think what higher education needs in this state is some revenue stream tied to it to protect its interests. As I said to you, one of two things need to happen here. You need to either undedicate everything we got in this budget so that people can properly manage the budget. It's just dedicated away. It's impossible to manage. You need to dedicate the whole thing and dedicate it by percentages, and the legislature move around the percentages. If they're not going to change anything, it's going to have a revenue stream to get some protection of some kind from somewhere. Texas is able, Texas got a 12-mile limit over there, and they've been able to take that money and dedicate it to the universities and protect them. The federal government will not let us have the 12-mile limit. We're stuck with the 3. So we have to find ways to deal with it. We're doing it this session. We found some ways to pay some of their unfunded accrued liability on their retirement system. We're trying to get that done. Everybody's working very hard to do it because they're the lone duck sitting out there now.
Do you think that higher ed has been permanently damaged in some way, or some way that will take how soon could we turn things around where we could stop the outflow of good faculty and also discouraging students?
Well, I think the damage has clearly been done. I mean, I'm very worried that LSU is very near falling out of a tier one status in the United States. I think that would extremely, extremely sad. But on the other hand, the move toward strengthening the community colleges may be helpful. One of the things we've done in this state, I think this is very important, is you go up in my neck of the woods, up in the Shreveport and Bossier area, in a 60-mile radius, I've got Southern University, Grambling University, Louisiana Tech, Northwestern, LSU, Shreveport, all within 60 miles, and it's like that all over the state. And to run four-year institutions, the overhead to run those is very, very expensive. To keep your accreditation, you have to have so much lab space, so many doctoral degrees. It's very expensive. Other states chose not to do that. They built a strong community college-based system, and then people matriculate out of the community college in the four-year system. We didn't do that here. We built the most expensive system you could run, and we're going to have to make changes there. And find dedicated revenue streams to protect them. That's my view. I would close by just telling you this. Out of every 100 kids that enter the ninth grade in this state and in America, about 20 are going to get a college degree. About 5 more will get some college. That leaves 75 out there that's going to be your skilled labor force that's got to have some training. That's why the technical colleges and community colleges are so critical.
Robert, thank you so much for being with us. You've been very kind to stay on a little bit longer than I know you probably should have, but we appreciate you being with us, appreciate your service, and I hope you'll give my love to your lovely wife, Claudia.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Good luck with the rest of the session.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
So we're wrapping up this discussion. Before we take a short break, I want to thank my guests again, John Bell Edwards and Senator Robert Adley, for being with us today. When we return, we will talk with two guests about taking care of various creatures that you might find in your backyard, turtles, raccoons, injured squirrels, that kind of thing. We'll be right back with that discussion after this timeout on WRKF. Welcome back. I'm Bob Mann, sitting in for Jim Inkster, who's off for a couple of days. If you've lived in Baton Rouge long enough, you've come across a box turtle, most likely in your own backyard. I know we are visited by those creatures several times a year, their arrival usually announced by the frantic barking of our dog. They're beautiful and peaceful creatures, and I love it when they visit us. Occasionally, I even will stop and help one across the street, as I know some of you do. So why the talk about box turtles? Well, if you happen to read the front page of yesterday's Baton Rouge Advocate, you may have noticed a fascinating story about Robert Zinn, a retired staff member of the LSU Chemistry Department who kept 115 box turtles in his backyard. At least he did until April, when state wildlife and fisheries agents seized 103 of them and charged him with not having the proper permits to keep the turtles. We're not going to be getting into the legalities of that case today, but rather talking this morning about the joys and the challenges of studying and caring for wildlife as an amateur. We're joined on the phone today by Robert Zinn, the subject of that fascinating story in yesterday's paper. Mr. Zinn, welcome.
beautiful day to be alive.
It is, indeed. And also here in the studio with Deborah Simmons-Harris. She was the subject of another story in The Advocate last year. She created her own wildlife sanctuary for orphaned and injured animals. It's called Wild Babies Care Sanctuary, an all-volunteer facility with two goals: to restore the animals to health so they can be released to their natural environment, and to educate the public, especially children, about the environment and biodiversity. Robert Zinn and Deborah Simmons-Harris, welcome to the show today. Thank you for joining
us.
So, Robert, let me start with you. Those of us who read that story yesterday in The Advocate with great interest, were fascinated by the legalities, but also by how someone happens to accumulate 115 box turtles in his backyard, in addition to a bunch of other turtles. How did you fall in love with turtles?
Well, when I was 6 years old, my folks bought me one of these little dime store turtles. The red-eared sliders, and it was fun watching Myrtle grow, and unfortunately she escaped from our backyard in Texas when I was about 18, but I hope she's somewhere in the irrigation ditch behind our house there, still making babies. Later, I occasionally rescued box turtles from the roads around Wichita Falls, Texas, because they would get down the curb and they couldn't get back up, and they would bake on the roads. I didn't keep any of those turtles because I knew I didn't know how to care for them. In the 1980s here, I was on my way to work at LSU one day, and I saw an elderly box turtle crossing the road, and I stopped and picked her up. And I was curious about how old she was and things like that, so I decided to study her. And over the years, from the 80s up until the mid-90s, I rescued about 47 box turtles from the roads around Baton Rouge and other areas of the state, and even over into Texas New Mexico, Texas border. And over the years, I watched when my turtles would lay eggs, and I dug the eggs up, and I brought them in, and I would put the eggs in a Dannon yogurt cup with some damp sphagnum moss and incubate them and watch them hatch. And by 1996, I had about 160 some odd box turtles in my backyard.
How big of a backyard do you have?
It's fairly large, but the area where I keep the box turtles is about 380 square feet.
Okay.
Because the box turtles are not good swimmers, and I needed to keep them away from where my water turtles were, because if they get in the water turtles' pond, they can drown. I've lost turtles that way before. It took a while to learn some things.
Let me interrupt you there, Robert, just for a second, and throw this to Deborah. What would you say to someone like Robert? And I think if I understand right, the two of you know each other.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you say to someone like Robert or me, who I've spent a lot of time last year trapping raccoons in my backyard, who were quite a menace to my dog, and it never occurred to me to keep one of them as a pet. They're pretty mean animals.
They're not
the kind of thing you'd want your children around. But what would you, if I found an injured squirrel, for example, or a turtle, what would you say that I should do as a responsible person to the animal and to society? What should I do?
Locate a wildlife rehabilitator.
And how would I find one?
Well, in Louisiana, there is a website for the Louisiana Wildlife Rehabilitators Association. You could look it up by looking for wildlife rehabbers. You can check the veterinarian clinic at LSU Small Animal Clinic. They also have resources. Many vets now in Louisiana do have a resource list of rehabilitators. And even more importantly, you can call Wildlife and Fisheries, and they have a list also on their website for permitted wildlife rehabilitators. They also have a list of nuisance control people who are permitted also.
And so that would be specific to the animal. Like, for example, if I found a wounded squirrel versus a wounded possum or something, I would call a different person.
You would call one of those locations just to find out how to get in touch with a wildlife rehabilitator, or what your options are, especially between wildlife and fisheries and your wildlife rehabber.
Right. We're talking with Robert Zinn, who was featured in The Advocate yesterday for the large collection of box turtles that he once had until Wildlife and Fisheries took many of them away, and Deborah Simmons-Harris, who runs Wild Care Baby Sanctuary here in Baton Rouge. Robert, you're a certified wildlife rehabilitator. Does that only for turtles? Do people bring turtles to you?
I was a certified licensed wildlife rehabilitator, and until the denial of my permit for this year is adjudicated, I still am legally, but not as far as wildlife and fisheries is currently concerned. Though I do get calls quite often from people asking for help with turtle problems. My usual advice to people after finding out what the damage is to the turtle is to take it to the small animal clinic at LSU Vet School and donate it there, because they can care for the turtles, and most people cannot properly care for a turtle. It's a lifetime plus commitment with box turtles, especially since they live over 130 years.
Of the turtles you had or still have, were you able to determine the age of any of these, and what was the oldest?
I estimate the age on some of the turtles that I currently have as well over 100, from the fact that their shell is worn very smooth over the years. The younger turtles, you can see growth rings on there, and it's kind of like counting tree rings on a tree, but it's actually growth seasons rather than years.
So if I find a box turtle in my backyard, it's possible that turtle could be older than I am.
Definitely.
That's remarable. Deborah, tell us a little bit about what you do and the variety of animals that that you're taking care of, and also how someone could get involved with helping you, because you're not making money off of this, are you?
No, and that's actually a three-part answer for your questions. Number one, I am running a wildlife rehabilitation sanctuary, and that involves people bringing me animals that are either injured or are orphans, and I raise them with the intent to release them back out into the wild. That is all part of a big conservation ecological balance that we try to keep going here. To get involved, you need to call me, or you can call Wildlife and Fisheries and get in touch with a wildlife rehabilitator who you can work with.
What's your phone number? What number should they want to deal with you? They want to work with you. Who do they call?
They can call area code 225-953-0260. Or, which is a better contact, is to email me at wildbabiescare@cox.net.
And do you have a website that?
No,
that,
I do not have a website until somebody comes forward and volunteers to put one up for me. My days are very, very long. I don't have a lot of volunteers because it's a very time consuming volunteer action. But again, we can divide it up during the day. It's as I said, it's taking care of animals. It's even more involved in taking care of children. You've got to clean up after them. You have to clean them up, feed them, clean up, do cage care, do medication care a lot of times. There's keeping their environment absolutely clean, their cages, the room, the outside areas. Although it's very involved, it's wonderful. I love working with the animals.
What would you say is the most interesting or exotic animal you have right now?
Probably a fox that I'm taking care of, and we'll be heading to Colorado hopefully by the end of this month to a new sanctuary. It had been in somebody's possession for about 7 years, and it's not really releasable because it doesn't hunt very well. And it's become very acclimated to humans. So although if we let it go in the neighborhood, it probably would get in somebody's chicken coop or garbage or cause problems. It's not, they don't make good pets either. So that's, again, wildlife, for the most part, are not good pets.
Robert, do you agree? And if you had to do it all over again, would you do it the same way? Would you collect? Would you wind up with as many turtles as you have?
No, I definitely agree with her that if you see a turtle crossing the road, help it get to where it's heading. Mm-hmm. Because we've learned over the years that box turtles have ranges that they exist in, and if you move them several miles outside the range, they'll try to get back to it and will probably die if they can't. So it's best to leave them where they are native to. In 1996, I, along with many others, fought to stop the commercial trade in wild box turtles. At that time, hunters used trained dogs to catch box turtles. The hunters were paid $1 per turtle. Companies bought the turtles from the hunters and sold them to pet stores around the U.S. and other countries. Louisiana's exporters were shipping 10,000 box turtles per year overseas and earning over $45,000 each year. The U.S. was a signatory to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, the CITES Treaty. The box turtle was listed in Appendix 2 as a potentially endangered species. This obligated the U.S. to certify that the export was not detrimental to the species survival. Wildlife and Fisheries' Jeff Bounty wrote on behalf of the department in favor of continued export. I and several others criticized the science in his paper. The feds found that continued export could not be justified by the data. The state passed a law protecting the box turtle. Over the last 13 years, I helped save hundreds of thousands of box turtles from being exported. I estimate that each female saved lays about 450 eggs over her lifetime, and each of those eggs is necessary to maintain the population. The law had several flaws. In order to make things easy for field agents to enforce, it defined all box turtles found within the state, except those raised on licensed turtle farms, to be native wild box turtles. There was supposed to be a grandfather clause in there that would have made my turtles not wild, but that was never put in the regulations. And by passing the law, the legislature unconstitutionally took my personal property without compensation in violation of the 5th and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. And, I needed a special permit to allow me to continue to possess the group of box of 166 box turtles I then had in my backyard. Approximately 47 of those had been rescued from the roads, and the rest came from eggs laid by the rescued turtles over the 1986 to 1999 period.
Robert, I'm going to interrupt you there and invite our listeners to read the Advocate's story on the front page yesterday that goes into a lot of this background, which is very interesting. I know Deborah wants to jump in with a comment about something you said.
I do. Bob didn't go into the amount of details, but what he was actually doing was a big conservation effort. A lot of people don't understand that when they go interrupting the natural flow, for example, the capture and exportation of all those turtles, they're interrupting our natural biodiversity that exists. And as a wildlife rehabilitator, both Bob and I are very much concerned about the conservation of our animals, because that has a big impact all the way up and down the food chain, which interacts with our natural environment in itself that we live in. Do you agree, Bob?
Definitely.
So, Deborah, do you care for any turtles? Have turtles?
Yes, I have turtles.
Do you?
I do.
And what do you do for them?
I have a small area that's set aside for turtles that cannot be released, in which they exist in a natural environment. And then I do have three education permitted turtles that I use in the schools when I do my programs.
Okay. So again, give us the number how someone should contact you if they've got find an animal that they want to talk to you about.
I know I'm going to get deluged.
Volunteer, right?
Yes, I really, really need volunteers. You have to be permitted to be able to do wildlife rehabilitation with any of the rabies vectored animals. However, you can still work with me as a sub permittee, and with the goal, hopefully, of getting your own permit. You need to be 18 years old to be able to work with these rabies vectors.
Okay.
I do work with children. I do programs with the children. I'll go into school. I do take education animals in also. You can contact me at 225-953-0260, or please, I'd prefer if you emailed me at wildbabiescare@cox.net.
Okay. Thank you very much. Deborah Simmons-Harris and Robert Zinn, thank you for joining us today. That's all the time we have. I want to thank John Bell Edwards and Robert Adley for joining me earlier to talk about the legislative session. We'll be tomorrow, be back tomorrow for another wrap-up of the session with two close observers of the legislature and also former Governor Kathleen Babineaux-Blanco. Thanks for joining us today. Have a wonderful day.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at wrkf.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.